a lot's happening around Cascadia, and this is where we plant our feet. But nonetheless, Nicholas Johnson was a commissioner of the FCC, now teaches at the University of Iowa College of Law. And his reflections on net neutrality are what we are going to be hearing today. A brief quote: the genius of the internet has always been its openness. Anyone with an internet connection can access any of its public content from anywhere, anytime. Those features built into the internet's architecture are unfortunately not built into the new net neutrality law. And in other words, every aspect of our lives has been thoroughly corporatized, monetized, and privatized. The only thing that's not privatized is, in fact, our private lives. That said, back to the headlines. The first five-year review is out, and the results are in. The effort to clean up the soil and groundwater contamination at the nation's only plant for assembling and disassembling nuclear weapons has been effective, they say, so far. No report as to how well those who are protecting and doing the assembling and disassembling are doing, but we know that there are cracks in the system. Our military is beginning to show signs of wear and tear, and well, it might after many, many years of being on high alert that the likes of Mozambique were about to attack us. Republican Clifford Benz, an Eastern Oregonian lawmaker, is floating a bill he hopes would stave off strict federal regulations. Of course. Clifford has found no friend of federal regulations, stiff or otherwise, on cattle grazing in order to protect habitat for the greater sage grouse. Well, this may sound like yet another argument over small brown bird, but you know, the small brown bird fits into a much larger an ecosystem. We have absolutely no idea. It is so far beyond the complexity of the natural world. It's so far beyond our algorithms, our ability to understand how all of it works, that it would behoove us to, before we bring yet another creature to the brink of extinction and beyond, maybe we ought to look at where this whole thing fits together. And this month, cordite still in the air, that sulfurous scent of hell, a frustrated group of local justice officials has finally figured out it's time for an approach that other cities have already been using for years regarding gangs. If they haven't been using it for years, something's not right. Maybe it's time to think a little bit about some financial uplift. Possibly it's not, we don't have enough police. Especially since Portland is notably white, isn't it? And whenever you see the pictures of the successful gang interventions, it's generally people with darker skin who get intervened upon. And hey, kids, you want to jumpstart your career in journalism? Yep, that's all you have to do is jump on the Gangland Express. Every publication, everything, every newspaper, blog, weekly, monthly, daily, you name it, it's all over Portland's gangs. Isn't that interesting? A small demographic has fueling the careers of many, many graduates of our finest halls of learning. The National Security Agency has placed software on nearly 100,000 computers around the world that allows the U.S. to conduct surveillance on those machines using radio frequency technology. That's right, RIF. Exactly. The New York Times, in fact, reported this last Tuesday. Here's the interesting part. Yes, what the story was rehashed on, of all things, Fox. And have you, anybody out there noticed lately, not just reading news stories, read the connections between them and read where they appear and the order in which they appear, the pattern. It's the patterns that these stories create. That's where the news is. That's where it lurks. And the government has released some heavily redacted legal opinions, but ProPublica, the ACLU, would say it is not enough. This is more from the Edward Snowden files. And finally this. Senator Dianne Feinstein says that she once found a drone peeking into the window of her home. A kind of cautionary tale she wants lawmakers to consider, say, look, at allowing commercial drone use. That's right. It's time to rush out and buy a drone now. Just like, I suppose this would be the left's equivalent of draining the gun shops of ammunition prior to the possibility of a ruling on gun control. For everyone else, it's run out and buy a drone, because if you don't, they could easily be outlawed. But the mental image that we are nonetheless left with of Dianne Feinstein with a drone about a foot off to the left of her nose. This from the National Weather Service today. Areas of fog early on, and plenty of fog. Otherwise, becoming mostly sunny towards the middle of the day, highs around 48, and east-northeast winds, light tonight. Again, fog, dense, heavy fog, partly cloudy during the day, and lows around 38, calm winds overnight, Friday, tomorrow. Again, fog starting out, and gradual clearing, highs around 51, light east wind for tomorrow night. Again, fog, and mostly overcast, lows around 34. It's going to be cold, and an east wind, very light, about 5 miles per hour. That's it for you, for the conventional weather. We have an alternative report, the full flower moon in Gemini is 15 days old. And on all three, the synodic, the biodynamic and sidereal fronts, it's all extremely optimistic. Here, the Pacific Northwest, unless you have a really, really large counter above the sink or windowsill to grow things on, or a vast greenhouse or cold frames, these are going to be challenges. But nonetheless, synodic outlook, it's a good time to sow root vegetables, berries, bulbs, onions, biennials and perennials. And the biodynamic outlook, they say that with the moon in Gemini, it's an air sign, good time for flowering plants. And the sidereal forecast moon in Cancer, they say that this is a good time for germination. And one might start with berry canes on berry bushes, the first round of light pruning. That's about it. We managed to get through the headlines. And before we delve into news for Aunt Cascadia, I want to welcome Nicholas Johnson to the KBOO Airwaves. Good morning, Nicholas. Thanks for
being with us. Good morning, Chris. How are you out there?
We're here, and we are all. The discussion, of course, has been, what is this new ruling, this new law, going to do? The net neutrality issue is something that will indeed affect all of us. Many of these specious laws that get passed may or may not affect us, but this is one that is going to touch most people's lives, even people who don't own computers, funnily enough. I mentioned going in that you were a commissioner of the FCC, and now you teach at the University of Iowa College of Law. So what I would like to ask about the what are some of the legal implications? What are we likely to run up against now that the internet has become monetized, essentially, and stratified? We are driving the elements of society, of our culture, further apart in many ways. And this is exactly what sociologists have been saying is plaguing society. Now, what are the downstream effects going to be?
Well, let me put all this in a little context, if I may, Chris.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court of the United States, unbeknownst to many people, has ruled that the First Amendment rights essentially belong to the owners of the mass media, so that no one has a legally enforceable or constitutionally enforceable right to go into a newspaper and demand to buy ad space or put a commercial on television or radio, nor do we have a right of entry into the mass media distributed by cable television, except for the public access channels that I've fought for when I was a commissioner of the FCC. So that is why, in that context, internet and the concept of net neutrality is so important to us, because the internet is the place where any and everybody can go who has a computer and an internet connection. They can post information on the internet. They can obtain other people's information, whether it's text or photos or videos or whatever it may be, come up with new services, create web pages for their business or organization or whatever. And we can download movies and all kinds of content. So that is what we mean by net neutrality, is that we separate control over content from control over the conduit, the cables and optic fiber and communication satellites that bring you this stuff, that the people who own and operate that should not be deciding what content you can get to, and should not be charging differential prices based on that content. Should not own content producers and encourage you to go to the content producers that they own rather than their competitors. So that's why net neutrality is so important to us. I should note that this is the second time the FCC has tried to provide net neutrality. So the FCC has been on our side on this, but the court has turned them down twice. And I think it's very important also to put in context what it is the court said and what the court did not say. The court did not say that net neutrality was a bad idea or somehow unconstitutional. The court did not say that the FCC could never protect net neutrality. What the court said was they went about it the wrong way. That you cannot call an internet service provider an information providing service and regulate it like a common carrier. You need to call them the common carriers that they are and treat them as such. And if you would do that, then it would be okay for the FCC to protect net neutrality, or at least the FCC would have a lot better shot at it. It's not a guarantee, but so the court has not said that we can't have net neutrality. They've just said that the FCC can't provide it in the way that they chose to provide it.
So that, in other words, it's a means, not the ends, that that the court had a problem with. Thank you so much for that, Nicholas. We're so grateful to have you. That does indeed help sort things out a bit, and does provide a glimmer of hope that possibly it is the internet is not, in fact, as many have predicted, dead in the water. Though dark nets seem to be rising all around us, and I want to thank you once again for joining us. My guest has been Nicholas Johnson, former commissioner.
I'm happy to be with you, Chris, and it's nicholasjohnson.org if anybody wants to know more.
And there is a lot more, and this is a wonderful source. Dr. Johnson has lived in this milieu for a while. This has been a Cascadia for Thursday, January 16th, 2014. Rock Bergeron engineered the show today. Thanks so much, Rock. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.
Flashpoint's an expanded investigation into Lyme disease and how the medical profession has dropped the ball in dealing with this new emerging epidemic. Also, an epidemic of police harassment and violence against young people working for justice for Andy Lopez. We're going to have more reports coming out of Santa Rosa, California. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. According to the Centers for Disease Control, Lyme disease is now the fastest growing infectious disease in the country. The CDC recently announced that rather than 30,000 new cases of Lyme disease each year in the United States, there are likely 300,000. Some people have compared the Lyme epidemic to the AIDS crisis of the 80s. Like AIDS, Lyme disease is being ignored politically and has not been responded to with an urgency by public health authorities. Let me tell you about my guest today, because we're going to look into what the disease is and the politics behind it. We have Dr. Jessica Bernstein. She's a psychologist who has written about the issue in a recent article that just came out on the cover of Truth Out, called From AIDS to Lyme, Will We Let History Repeat Itself? The article features Dr. Mark Conan. He was in the forefront of the AIDS movement, and he believes that history is repeating itself with Lyme disease. Dr. Conan was one of the first physicians to identify AIDS in 1981 and is the founder of the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. His work contributed to development of some of today's top HIV medications, and he's written over 70 publications on the treatment of AIDS. He is also one of the few people from the AIDS movement who have crossed over into the Lyme disease struggle. And in terms of Bernstein, she specializes in dealing with chronic illness and has been writing about Lyme disease since her diagnosis of the illness a couple of years ago. Well, I want to welcome you both to Flashpoints, and let me start with you, Dr. Bernstein. You have suffered from this disease. I want people to get a sense, people who don't understand, who don't have a friend, who don't have a relative struggling with this, help us understand how this impacted on your life and what it does to people in real terms.
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Dennis, for covering this story. I've probably had Lyme disease for the past 20 to 25 years, but I've also had lifelong type 1